Welcome to DevelopLex, a Middle Tech production hosted by me, Weston Lockhart, and Evan Knowles. This series will focus on the ins and outs of real estate development and investing, where we'll have the opportunity to sit down with the developers of our cities, veterans of the industry, and key people that have over time made a massive impact on communities and neighborhoods. The purpose of this series is to be able to bring a knowledge base to our audience beyond that of what reading a book or watching a how-to video ever could, and educate from those who have done it by hearing their stories, both good and bad, along the way. We feel that historically the learnings of real estate have been inaccessible without being connected, and we would love to open the doors to the next generation of doers, as well as shine a light on how visions of community have been brought to life. We hope you enjoy. Before diving in, we'll get a quick word from our sponsors. DevelopLex is sponsored by SV & Stone Commercial Real Estate, a full-service commercial real estate firm located in Lexington, Kentucky, affiliated with the SVN International Network, which is comprised of over 1,600 advisors and staff and 200-plus offices across the globe. The SV & Stone team consists of experienced commercial real estate advisors in the heart of the Bluegrass. SVN provides commercial real estate services to large corporations, middle-market businesses, and individual entrepreneurial investors. Serving the greater Lexington area, SVN offers advisory services for sales, leasing, management, and development of commercial properties locally, regionally, and nationally. With transaction volume of over $400 million, the advisors at SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate have vast experience and deep understanding of all aspects of commercial real estate. We are also sponsored by Lexington Pavement Suite. Lexington Pavement Sweep is a full-service property maintenance company operating in central Kentucky, specializing in parking lot sweeping, day portering, landscaping, and snow removal. From established retail properties to construction sites and everything in between, whether your property needs a daytime presence or a nightly sweep, Lexington Pavement Sweep will be there to ensure your property is starting the day pristine. Lexington Pavement Sweep is proud to be a part of DevelopLex, bringing the best of the best to all listeners. We are also sponsored by Community Trust Bank. Community Trust offers a wide variety of home loans, commercial loans, and small business loans to suit your financial needs, as well as mobile banking, internet banking, and bill pay. Their friendly and professional staff would love to assist you at one of their 6 Lexington locations. Community Trust Bank is committed to building communities built on trust. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, subject to credit approval.
All right. Welcome back to DevelopLex Podcast. We've got Evan and Weston here. Today, we're sitting down with Joseph Back. He is a UK graduate. He is a business partner of mine, and he is killing the game in the real estate industry. The reason we wanted to get him on this podcast is because he's really young. He, after he graduated, set out with intention and made sure that he started a business and grew that business very rapidly. And so we want to talk about how he did that, how he started investing in real estate, and how he's grown his business. So Joseph, thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you guys. Really, really honored to be on here, seeing some of the other names as I've been listening to the podcast, and the fact that you invited me on is pretty crazy to me, but I'm really excited.
Yeah, well, I think you've got a unique perspective. You know, I think a lot of our audience is young. They want to learn about investing. I think you're at a stage where, you know, you've had a lot of growth. You've got a lot of perspective. You know, you might not be a Dudley Webb or a Phil Greer yet. I'm sure you will, but at least you can talk about the perspective you've had of getting started. So before we get into any of that, though, let's get into, you know, your background. Where are you from, education, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, grew up in central Kentucky, in Versailles, actually. Went to the University of Kentucky and got a degree in finance and got right into real estate after that. Just kind of, you know, how I got into real estate, you know, basically went to UK, like I said, I was going to get a finance degree and initially thought I wanted to do something kind of high finance related. Went and did an internship up in New York City in investment banking and hated my life. Didn't really know where I was going to go. Actually got the chance to get into a class called Intro to Real Estate UK, and it was kind of an interesting class. They met on Wednesday nights from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. So it was a long class. We met once a week, and it was taught by an adjunct professor, which basically means this person's not a full-time professor. They have a career outside of teaching. And this professor's name was Jonah Mitchell. Interesting guy, very, very in your face. You couldn't get away with anything in that class, but he was very successful. He owned his own brokerage, owned a property management company, and owned a large portfolio of rental properties right here in Nicholasville, Kentucky. And he made it. And this guy was very successful, and he was pretty much teaching this class to give back. And it was the first time where I sat in a classroom in UK and been inspired to want to be like the professor. And so that's kind of what got me interested in real estate initially. And from there, to start consuming content and, you know, educating myself, and then eventually, you know, taking a job in the space.
Yeah. And how did you get into, your first deal? So you graduated college, or maybe you didn't even graduate college, so you got your first deal. But talk about, you know, that first deal and how you did it.
Yeah. My first deal was in June of 2018. So it was a month after I graduated. So I ended up, right when I graduated, I joined a real estate investing company here in Lexington. Basically joined their team to create a off-market acquisitions vehicle. You know, up to that point, they had about 100, 120 single-family rental properties, and they bought all those on the market from realtors. And they were wanting to try and get some deals off market. And so I came on to kind of, build that acquisition vehicle. And through that, I got access to a lot of really good deals. And that very first deal was actually a single family house here in Lexington. Kind of a burnout landlord posted a big group of about 45 properties in this Facebook group that he was wanting to sell. He was just, he'd been through it and he was ready to get rid of them. And so I basically took that list, and that night I was up till about 4 a.m. Kind of running my own little appraisals for all 40 of the properties to figure out which of these are worth us making an offer on. Because he put the address, his asking price, and what they were rented for. And I identified five houses that I thought, these are at least 25% discount to market value. They would cash flow really well. And so then I went to my boss at the time and said, hey, I've dug through all of this. I think these five are worth making an offer on. I think if we try to buy a package of five, we might be able to even get a discount from what he's asking. But I'd like to buy one of them just because I did all this work, all this legwork, and he was okay with that. And so I was actually able to kind of pick which one of those I wanted and got a little house over on Northwood Drive here in Lexington, North Lexington. And the way I funded the deal is actually I partnered with my dad. Obviously being, how old was I then? Being 22, and not having any money, but being hungry, I went to my dad, and he's not some wealthy guy, and he works at the Dixie Cup factory. He's been there for 30 years, but he had a house in Versailles that that I grew up in, that they've been paying the mortgage down on for year upon year upon year, and he had a lot of equity, and so we were able to pull out a home equity line of credit on their property, on my parents' house in Versailles, and use that money to buy this house for $70,000. It was already rented for $850. It's actually through Section 8. What most people don't know with Section 8 is, every year you can do a rent raise request form to the housing authority here in Lexington, and they'll typically grant a small raise. Well, this landlord hadn't done that in 3 years. So, being the ambitious guy I am, I sent them a rent raise request form to go from $850 to $1,150. And they said, no, not a chance. We'll come up to $1,000 a month. So I was able to raise the rent $150 before we even bought it. So we bought it cash from the money we got from the home equity line of credit for $70,000. And then basically day two of ownership, I went to a local bank. It was actually Kentucky Bank, which is now Stockyards Bank and Trust. Said, hey, I want to get a mortgage on this property. And they said, all right, we'll give you 80% of whatever it appraises for. Set the appraiser out, it appraised for $100,000. And I could have pulled an extra 10 grand out, but we were being a little conservative, paid ourselves back. And now we had a property we had no money invested in, was cash flowing for us every month. And that tenant was paying down our debt every month as well and building that equity for us. So that was my very first deal, probably one of my best deals. if I could do that over and over, I would love to. But yeah.
That's awesome. And, good for you for getting creative, being ambitious there, doing it right out of college. That would be scary for a lot of people. I hear that over and over again. People, I don't have nearly the portfolio as you, but people just wonder how I got a house so early. They're, nervous. I think the fact you did it right out of college is special. Now, to contrast that and set the tone for the rest of the conversation, I want you to now talk about, where have you been able to build your business? Are you able to talk about some figures? You don't have to give exact dollar figures, but talk about the number of units you have and the size of your business that you have today, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So in Central Kentucky, so I've got two businesses. I've got my buy and hold company up here in Central Kentucky, and then I actually live down in Alabama, and I have a wholesaling and flipping company down in Montgomery, Alabama. And so up in Central Kentucky, right now I've got around 120 residential rental units, and then another five commercial properties that have about 25 doors, if you say, with that as well. And down in Alabama, I've got about another 25 residential rental units, you know, small apartment complexes and houses. And then what I spend the majority of my day on is the wholesaling business down here, which we've got 9 full-time employees in the office down here now. And this year we'll buy and sell 170 houses. And, you know, as far as revenue, we do it right at $2.2 million this year in assignment revenue. So definitely grown a lot. It's been really exciting to see. More excited for the future.
Yeah, and obviously you've scaled that from that first house that you bought on North Lexington. Did you have a picture of what you wanted to your business to be when you started? Or
yeah, I'm a very goal-oriented person. So you know, every single day I write down
my
long-term goals, my annual goals, yeah, and my quarterly goals. Evan's seen my spreadsheet. I write them down in a notebook every day too, and it keeps me focused. I'm very analytical, very goal-oriented. And so, yeah, I had a goal. One of my goals was actually to get to 50 rental units by the time I turned 25. Luckily, I was able to surpass that you know, pretty well. And now my goal is to get to 1,000 rental units by age 30. So very ambitious, but, you know, hey, I might miss it and get to 900. I'd still be pretty happy.
Pretty happy with that. And something I noticed, just a sidebar from the first story too, and I bet this is a recurring theme throughout, is that you asked for the order. There's a guy in my office that always says, nobody knows what you want unless you ask. And so on those first 5 properties that you vetted, you asked for that first one, right? You asked to be a part of that deal or to control that deal yourself. Do you find yourself getting more confident with that as you scale your business and add more units and, you know, have a little bit more clout?
Yeah. It definitely helps. I mean, over time, it's just crazy to think about. I mean, you know, obviously that first deal is the most nerve-wracking. I mean, you don't know it until you've done it, but just hopping and doing that first deal is the most important thing you can do. And then from there, things start to get a little easier. And then as you do more and more deals, you build more and more connections, you build more and more your relationships and kind of credibility, and it becomes easier and easier. Now, obviously, I'm not just maintaining the same rate of house buying that I had before. I'm always trying to grow that and do more and establish new relationships. But yeah, I'm always asking for it. Yeah.
I want to walk through, you know, how you've been able to grow at this rate and some of the things that you've done strategy wise. So first, I want to talk about, you know, kind of, you know, where does this all start? Well, you've got to find deals. So how are you getting access to deals? What are some ways that you're finding creative ways to, you know, get in the door with these people?
Yeah. So owning, you know, the wholesale business in Montgomery, and then I actually have a small kind of direct to seller wholesaling and flipping company in Lexington as well. And what both of those companies are doing is a ridiculous amount of direct to seller marketing. So in both markets, we're running TV commercials and all the local TV stations. We're sending out thousands upon thousands of postcards every single week saying that we want to buy your house. We've got, you know, 10 full-time cold callers in Mexico that are just constantly calling sellers asking if they're looking to sell. Online advertising campaigns going. And so by owning the wholesaling and flipping business and that, you know, funding all the lead generation and direct to seller marketing we're doing, you know, that's kind of one of the things I love about this business. Not only does it, you know, provide an income for me, but nobody gets to see better deals than we do. Now we may choose to wholesale or flip some of those. But as far as, you know, getting access to good deals, owning those businesses and doing all that direct seller marketing is the number one way.
And just in case people don't know that are listening to this, explain wholesaling in an elevator pitch.
Yeah. So what I'll say is our Montgomery wholesale business, we're a sales and marketing company, and our product happens to be houses. So much like a used car lot buys used cars at a discount and then marks them up and sells them, we're doing the exact same thing. We're buying discounted houses, we're locking them up, we're putting them under contract, and during our due diligence period, we're finding a buyer that's willing to pay a $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 spread. And then at the closing table, the buyer brings, let's say we got it for $50,000, we find a buyer that wants to pay $65,000, they bring $65,000 to closing, the seller walks with $50,000, and we walk with $15,000. So the way I describe it is, you know, we're not out there swinging hammers or what you see on HGTV. We are a sales and marketing company whose product happens to be houses.
Yeah. And, you know, when you get these under contract, you know, you've got to do some kind of due diligence. What kind of due diligence are you doing?
Yeah, so I'll say for me, there's a lot of people out there that are really good at, you know, they can buy a deal maybe at market value or close to market value, and they're really good at getting rehab done cheaply or just being creative. You know, I know, Weston, you're really, really creative with the retail stuff. For me, I'm not that good at managing properties, at rehabbing properties, but what we're really, really, really good at is finding good deals. So for me, I'm just, you know, trying to find properties that I know if I bought it today, I can turn around and sell it for a $20,000 markup tomorrow. As long as I'm doing that, I don't have to be good at all the other stuff. I just need to know that, hey, this property fixed up, it's after repair value is X. I need to get it at least 80% of that minus repairs. And that's what I can sell it to the investor at. So even below that is where I get my spread. So say it's a $100,000 house fixed up, multiply that by 80%, that's 80,000. Maybe it needs 15,000 in repairs, that's 65,000. We're gonna lock that deal up for 50, 55,000 and sell it to our investors at that 20% discount.
Yeah, and for the ones that you keep, for the ones that you add to your own portfolio, what are some calculations you're running to see if this is a good investment that you're willing to hold on to?
Yeah, so the vast majority of my portfolio is residential rental properties. And the number one way I acquire those is through what's called the BRRRR strategy. So buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. So I've got to know that I'm getting this house, A, for at least a 20% discount so that I can cash out refi from the bank. And B, I've got to know that it's going to cash flow. So you know, basically, I'm not walking away losing money every single month. Or if it doesn't cash flow, the bank won't even refinance the money to me. So typically for me, what that looks like, you know, I don't really get into the nitty gritty unless we're talking about the larger kind of commercial properties. But single family houses, it's the 1% rule. So if I can be all in for, it's a $100,000 house and needs rent for $1,000 a month. That's the really quick and easy way I do it. Because end of the day, cash flow is just what keeps me in the game. You know, I'm not building this 1,000 rental properties for the cash flow. I'm building it for the long-term net worth building that's going to create for me and the equity. It's almost like a forced savings program. You know, every single one of these houses, you know, there's $100, $200, $300 worth of debt being paid down by these tenants every single month. If I can get enough of those, hold them for 20 years, they're all going to be free and clear. They're all going to be appreciated a whole lot. And it's going to build my net worth more than anything else can.
Gotcha. And so I guess that kind of pivots us to, obviously, how old are you? 25. You have some ambitious goals. Obviously, that takes cash. So the bank you've already mentioned is obviously a partner. Are there other partners that you take on in this? And how do you vet those partners and kind of talk about them?
Yeah. So it's been different types of partners along the way. You know, initially, obviously, I owned quite a few properties with my father, and he kind of had, you know, the main thing he had going for him was he had a W-2 job. You know, even when I was working for the company I initially started with, I was a 1099. So, you know, it's very hard to get approved at the bank for those refinances when you're 1099. So having him, you know, he was crucial for that part of that chapter of my rental property buying because he had the W-2. He could get the financing for us to cash out of those deals. At this point, I don't partner as much. I'll partner on larger deals because obviously they do require a lot of cash. We're starting to buy some more commercial properties and, you know, actually putting the 20-25% down. You know, partnered with Evan on some properties that, you know, basically just needed an equity partner to bring some of the cash so that we could get it done. And worked out perfectly with them selling some other properties. They were able to do a 1031 and it was a win-win for everyone. But I can't give you a solid answer on that. Some of it was because I needed that W-2 employee. And now a lot of it's just not having, you know, maybe the enough cash to do some of these larger deals.
Yeah. And, you know, one other aspect that I know you take advantage of throughout, you know, these last several years is hard money lending. So for listeners, explain, you know, hard money and how you've leveraged it and advantages of that.
Yeah, it's huge. Again, you know, being young, your biggest limiting factor is capital. And so, you know, me and my dad can only BRRRR so many properties with that $70,000 home equity line of credit. You know, through networking and establishing that credibility, you're able to get connections with private individuals that want to lend their own money on real estate deals. So what a hard money lender is, it's just a private individual. So I work with five or six of them here in Lexington, and most of them are actually people who used to be rental property investors and still are. And they've kind of graduated from wanting to rehab any more properties or deal with management, and they just want that easy check in the mail. And so they'll take their own capital and say I have a deal I want to buy for $100,000. They will put up that $100,000 and get a mortgage on the property so that I can buy. We'll use that $100,000, and they'll have a first mortgage on the property. So if I were ever to not pay, they could foreclose on the property and take it from me. And in return, I'm going to pay them an interest. And it's usually a much higher rate of interest than what, you know, in the market for like a homeowner mortgage. Most of the ones I work with now are between 10 and 12%. So a much better rate than what they could get out in the stock market or you know, the bond market right now as well. And so it's very advantageous for both parties. I get a lot more capital to fund my deals, and they get a, you know, asset-backed loan that is very safe with a very high return relative to other opportunities right now.
Cool. And so I like to describe as what we just went through as like your toolkit. You know, you have a toolkit, you have a strategy, you have methods of growing your business. Now let's talk about, you know, some failures and some ways that you want to help our listeners that might be wanting to get into this as well, avoid hardships that you might have been able to avoid yourself. What's some things that might come to mind?
Yeah. Number one is just, you know, getting too emotionally attached to a deal, you know, especially as you're trying to get this commercial stuff, it's really easy to not just look at the numbers, but hey, man, I'm starting to buy all these properties in my hometown for sales. It's kind of like, man, I want to be that guy that owns everything. But you can't just go into these deals with that emotional baggage. You've got to be analytical and stay analytical despite all the emotions. You know, I bought a few deals, you know, some of the commercial deals I bought in for sales, I've probably not overpaid, but been right at market value just because, you know, it's a building maybe that I've driven past my whole life. And it's like, man, it'd be crazy if I could own that. And I'm willing to pay whatever I need to own that because there's a sense of pride that I get from owning it. So that's one mistake. You know, a mistake we've had a few times is, especially when you're wholesaling, you know, I like to be, you know, there's a lot of wholesalers out there that, you know, they'll lock up deals at too high prices, just trying to find a buyer that'll pay even more. And then they can't find anyone and they'll back out of the deal. You know, we like to promise that we're going to close on the deal no matter what. So any deal we put under contract, we believe in. And that means if we can't find a buyer, then I have to buy it myself. And let's just say anytime that happens, there's probably a reason that all the other buyers didn't buy it. It's not a good deal. So I've lost money on a few flips that were kind of forced flips because no one else bought it, but I want to honor our agreement. And it's not been too bad, you know, $5,000-$10,000 here and there. But again, the biggest thing is just not having that emotional attachment to any given property, not getting too wrapped up in it. There's always going to be another deal, and you've got to stay disciplined.
Ryan Foster said the same thing. So great minds think alike. And I think it's important. You know, it's hard not to. You know, you're buying something that's very expensive, and oftentimes it's attached to some kind of localization that you care about. And for you, that was for sales. For me, that'd be Lexington or E-Town. You know, people care about where they're from and care about the cities they live in, and it's easy to do that. And it's easy to care about something that, you know, it's a cool neighborhood, or it's just a cool house. You know, it doesn't matter if you're an investor. What's the numbers? What's the cash flow? You know, we were talking about that earlier. You were talking about when you first got into real estate, you learned that you were interested in and curious about it. You started consuming content. What content were you consuming? How did you learn about this stuff? For me, one of the go-tos is always BiggerPockets. But what are some other ways you were learning?
Yeah, BiggerPockets is number one. I mean, that you know, now it's a 3-time-a-week podcast. Back then, it was just a weekly podcast. And for that, it wasn't just the X's and O's of real estate, but every single week they had, you know, normal people like myself on that were having massive success in real estate. So it gave me that motivational drip that I needed every week. But beyond that, it was just kind of scouring the web. I mean, I'd say BiggerPockets was the number one resource by far. And then also just having more local knowledge. And, you know, there's a really great Facebook group called the Bluegrass Real Estate Investors Group. And just, you know, networking in there. I mean, you know, basically the winter break between the first and second semester of my senior year, I just posted my resume in there. It was basically like, hey, I really want to learn about real estate. I feel pretty good about the numbers, but I have no idea how to swing a hammer or how to analyze a rehab budget or anything construction related. I will come paint for you, hammer things for you for free. I'll do whatever you want for free if you just let me shadow you if you're flipping a house or something. And, you know, I was able to get with a few other local investors, and that was what actually ended up opening the door to me meeting what became my future boss at the company I worked at. So just networking is huge too. I think I've learned more from networking here within the local, you know, market that you're in, then, you know, what I've consumed online, it's a lot more, because you meet people that are doing what you want to do in your market. It becomes very real to you. And that makes it a lot easier to actually do yourself.
Yeah. I think, you know, what you mentioned about the shadowing thing, I did the same thing when I was first analyzing deals. This was even before Defiant Capital, maybe. I reached out to a home inspector. I said, hey, let me shadow you on a few of your inspections. I don't know what to look for in a home. I don't know what dangers there are in a home. I don't know what kind of code I need to be paying attention to. Let me just shadow you on a few of your inspections. And I learned a ton, because real estate's like one of those things. You only got to touch it and feel it. You got to talk to the people that are in the middle of it, because even though you're consuming a lot of content, there's still that big mental barrier of I'm purchasing this very expensive thing. And so it's way easier to just go shadow people that are doing it, get to know their lifestyles, get to know what they look for in deals or what they look for in homes and properties, and then go from there. You know, it's one thing to jump from reading a book or a podcast to buying a home. It's another thing to go from podcast to shadowing somebody and then buying a home. I think that's important, and it's interesting to hear you did the same thing.
Yeah, so a lot easier jump.
Let's now transition to a part I'm really looking forward to, which is just kind of like some random movements and trends going on in the real estate industry that, you know, you've got good insights to. You're almost engaging with it in a way on a regular basis. So talk about iBuying. You know, it's not exactly what you're doing, but it has some similar similarities. So for those that are listening, define iBuying, and then we'll go from there.
Yes. So iBuying, you know, there's a few big players in the space. You got Zillow, you got OfferPad, you got Opendoor. Essentially what they're doing is, you know, you go to their website, you type in your address, and they spit back an offer for what they can pay for your house. Now, obviously, if you accept that preliminary offer, they're going to come out, do an inspection of the home, and that offer's probably going to come down a little bit. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, just basically buying homes, you know, online. Basically, they're making that offer online, and then your home's sold. It's a very easy process. You don't have to list it. You don't have to do the repairs. And then they're going to actually buy that property with cash, and then they're going to list it for a very small markup and maybe make some money.
Yeah.
Most likely not.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been tracking it just because obviously I'm building a software company in the space as well. There are people out there that believe, you know, real estate agents are going away. There's all kinds of dialogue around, you know, what that means for the space, what iBuying means. How big do you think can actually get?
So I'd say I didn't give a lot of attention to it till about 2 months ago. And the reason for that is I'm a part of this mastermind group called The Collective Genius, and it's a bunch of very high level real estate investors, most of them way more successful than me. We meet up quarterly, and the most recent meeting was in Phoenix. And you know, we're in the big auditorium. There's about 150 companies there all across the nation. And the most successful guy there runs this company called New Western Acquisitions. They buy and sell 20,000 houses a year across the nation. They have 50 different offices. I mean, largest guy in the room by far. He gets up there and just throws up a slide, and it's got 20 logos on it. It's all the kind of iBuying or power buying companies that are coming to the space. And he said, who here knows all these companies? A few hands raised, not many. He said, who all is studying all these companies? Nobody raised their hand. He said, if you don't know these companies, and if you don't study these companies, you're going to become the Blockbuster and they're going to be the Netflix. And so we were all like, oh, crap. This guy is the most successful guy in the whole room. And he's really, really genuinely concerned about this. We need to pay attention. So from there, I started, you know, consuming a lot more content about iBuying and learning about it. And it, you know, the scary part for me is, you know, obviously we do a ton of sales and marketing. It costs a lot of money. And at the end of the day, you know, the reason I'm doing this business is to make a profit. You know, he basically stood up there and said, I could go into the boardroom of any of these 20 companies and ask them to list me their top five priorities right now. And not a single one of those priorities is going to be profit. And so that's scary. And not to mention, you know, there's a lot of room for disruption in this industry. The whole reason my business exists is because the housing market is so inefficient. Houses sell for way below what they're worth all the time. You know, for example, if you inherited a house today and it needed a bunch of work and it was 3 hours away, you may sell to a company like mine for 30, 40% what it's worth. If you inherited a bunch of shares of Apple stock, it doesn't matter, you know, how desperate you are. You're going to sell them on the stock market for the exact price that everybody else is getting. And so all that inefficiency, there's just a ton of room for disruption. And these guys, finally, with all the money that's been printed, they've got the firepower to come after us and to come, you know, come after that inefficiency. And they're doing it. Now, they're not doing it profitably or even close to profitably yet, but they don't have to. And that's the scary part.
Yeah, they don't have to yet. You know, one day they will, you know, and, you know, one of the ways they can do that is attach some of these ancillary services onto that transaction. You know, it's unlikely they're ever going to be profitable just on the spread of what they're buying and selling his homes at, just because of the fluctuations of the market. You've got cycles, you know, it's unlikely for them to ever be profitable on that standpoint. But where they can be profitable are these fees that they attach to these deals, like mortgage, insurance, title, you know, things of that nature that they're trying to move towards. But like you said, you know, these companies are so early that they're not worried about profits, just like many of the tech companies that we see out in the space. I am interested to hear your thoughts on, I've been studying, we study the same person, you know, Mike Dilpreet is his name. I think it's how you pronounce his last name. He doesn't ever believe that this will disrupt more than 8 to 9% of the entire housing market. The housing market's gigantic, right? So he doesn't think it's going to get over 10% of the transactions. Who do you think iBuying's right for? So if somebody's listening to this and they might be interested in iBuying, you know, who is it right for? Because it's not right for everybody.
Yeah, and it works a lot better in certain markets. You the markets where there's
Phoenix is like
a lot of track homes. Phoenix, Las Vegas, those type of areas where, you know, every single home is just like the home next door. You know, we have a lot of those, you know, large developments of neighborhoods, and you know, the pricing is very stable. It can work really well, and you know, a lot of times. You might be able to walk away with more money selling to an iBuyer than if you listed your home yourself. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like you said, they're making all that money not on what they buy it for and then what they sell it for, but in all those ancillary services, you know, title, the commissions, and a number of other things. That's where the real money maker's at. And, you know, that's one of the other things that, you know, the CEO of New Western Acquisitions talked about. He said, every realtor in this room is a dead man or woman walking. He said, with the amount of technology coming into the space, your commissions are going to be dropping to next, you know, to way less than what they are now before you know it. And I believe in that too. I mean, the value of a realtor today is significantly less than what it used to be, at least in, you know, in the residential space, you know, what it used to be maybe 20, 30 years ago. And the price hasn't reflected that. They're still charging 6%. So that's why these companies can have success, is there's so much margin, you know, not just between what they buy and sell it for. But if you were to list your home today, what you actually walk away with is going to be 10% than what you sell, 10% less than what you sell it for. And that 10% is where they can make their money, all those commissions and other fees. So it'll be interesting. It's right for people that live in large cities, in neighborhoods where most homes are alike. That's who it's right for. And it's working.
And it's a convenience play, right? So if you want the best price for your home, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to go with an iBuyer. If you want convenience, you know, you're going to want to go with an iBuyer. And in many cases, really, it's a convenience play for the consumers, which at the end of the day is what technology is all about. You know, they use data. They use their efficiencies that they've built using their technology to provide more convenience to consumers. And it'll be, you know, time will tell whether or not the housing market is the right place for that. Right now, it seems as though, given their business models, they're not profitable. But again, they're not worried about profits. So long term, you know, that could change. I also want to talk about, you know, you mentioned when I asked you, what are some things you want to talk about on this podcast? Institutional buying. You know, there's massive institutionals, BlackRock, you know, many of those are buying homes at massive scales. Why are they doing that? And what are you seeing out there?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's crazy because we're even seeing it down here in Montgomery. Montgomery's a cash flow market, you know, very cheap housing relative to rents. Although we are a very small market in the grand scheme of things, you know, for most hedge funds or private equity funds that are buying houses, we'd be probably considered a secondary or tertiary market. But, you know, we've seen these big players come into the single family rental space the last 3 or 4 years in a big way. And they're sucking up a lot of the inventory. And the reason the opportunity exists is, again, part of the reason that you know, there's so much money funding these real estate tech companies and iBuying companies is, you know, the government's printed so much money and interest rates are so low that these hedge funds and institutional capital companies are going out and raising, you know, raising debt financing from insurance companies and pension funds at 2 or 3%. And so then they just got to go out and deploy that capital at a yield above that 2 or 3%, which they can very easily get in the single family rental space. You know, for example, here in Montgomery, we probably sell about 10 houses a month to a hedge fund out of Boston because they pay more than anyone else Their issue is not price. Their issue is just being able to deploy the capital to buy enough houses such that it's not sitting over here in this account over here. It's deployed and earning that return that's, you know, a very small yield above what they're having to pay these insurance companies. And there's a lot more room for that to go because, you know, right now, for example, I looked at it today and 2% of single family homes in the U.S. are owned by institutional capital. A lot more room to go. You know, we were recently down at a conference in Miami. It was an IMN conference for single family rental institutional capital providers and hedge funds and private equity funds. And the CEO what's the name of the company? Oh, I can't think of it. It's a big company out of Boston. Not the one we sell to, but they have, I think they own 30,000 homes. And he got up there when everyone was kind of like, you know, tuned in. This guy is a leader in the space. And Amherst Financial, that's the name of the company. The CEO of Amherst Financial. They own 30,000 homes across the U.S. And he said, I know you guys, you think the market's crazy right now. You may think we're in the seventh inning stretch. He said, I can tell you right now, we're not in the seventh inning stretch. We're not in the third inning. We're not in the first inning. He said, we're in the warm-ups. The amount of growth and room there's for growth for institutional capital to come into the single family rental space is 10x, 20x, 30x what it is right now. And as long as interest rates stay low like they are right now, it's a very easy moneymaker for all these hedge funds and private equity firms because the yield is there. And I don't see that changing. I mean, Montgomery, like I said, is a small market, but in places like Birmingham and even Louisville, there's 20, 30 hedge funds buying there, and they're soaking up 200, 300, 400 houses a month from the market. You know, it makes a meaningful impact, and it's kind of crazy to see what they've been doing lately.
You know, I've been trying to track this as well, and, you know, there's articles out there that, you know, this is not good for consumers. This is not good for, you know, buying houses and owning houses. Building equity is one of the bedrocks of, you know, American society and, you know, the American dream. And so there are some people wondering, you know, is this good where people are being forced to rent? You know, obviously 2% is a tiny, tiny portion of the market. But if he's saying this is just the early, early warm-ups, then what does that mean going forward? What percentage will that get to? And what does that mean for consumers? Have you thought much about that? Is that a worry that people should have?
I don't think so. I think, you know, one thing, again, it's all kind of playing into the same theme for me. It's just the single family rental market, and in large part the real estate market in general, but really the single family rental market specifically is an extremely inefficient market. So there's a lot of opportunity here. And anytime there's a lot of opportunity, there's going to have a lot of capital that's going to flow into it. And that's what's happening, you know, from iBuying to the institutional capital coming in and buying single family rentals. It all ties together into the same theme. And, you know, one thing you'll see is as markets get more efficient, they become more stable and returns go down, which means prices go up. And so, you know, I think it's long-term. I think housing is a great bet. But I think it'll be interesting to see how much longer, what percent of the housing market will institutional capital own eventually? What rate will that stabilize at? I don't know that answer, but I know it's going to be a lot more than what it is right now. So I'm trying to buy as many houses as I can right now, because I believe long-term it's going to be a really, really great investment.
Yeah. I mean, there's just not, you know, one of the problems is with COVID, supply chains have kept new homes from being built, the cost of building a new home. You know, we're seeing that in a lot of markets, you know, in Elizabethtown specifically. You know, that was part of that big news with Ford coming, you know, is how are we going to get that many houses? You know, we got 5,000 new jobs coming to Elizabethtown and there's not enough listings in Elizabethtown. You know, my parents had this problem. You know, they sold, downsized. They're looking for a home in Elizabethtown, couldn't find one, so they had to move outside of Elizabethtown. And this is happening across the nation. This is one of the reasons that, you know, these iBuyers and so many institutional buyers are able to do this is because, you know, supply is low and demand is, you know, high. And, you know, that will likely change with interest rates and some other things and supply chains getting more efficient. But, you know, I do think this is a trend that people need to pay attention to. And I'm with you. Like if you're wanting to invest money, you know, and if you can get into real estate, you need to try to do everything you can too, because it's just such a great hard asset that's never going to go away.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Now, last question. We always like to end it on, you know, local to Lexington. Obviously, your heart is part of it in Lexington. You know, I believe you plan on moving back. So what do you love about Lexington? What interests you about Lexington? Obviously, you're from Versailles, right next door. But talk about the Lexington market, where most of our listeners are.
Yeah. No, I love Lexington. I don't think I had enough of an appreciation for it until I moved
somewhere
else.
Common theme with people.
I miss it even more. Yeah. So, I mean, my wife is in vet school at Auburn University. That's what brought me down here. We have the full intention to go back when she graduates here in a year and a half. And one thing about Lexington, I love living there. But on top of that, I love investing there. I don't think there's a, for me, I don't think there's a better place to invest in real estate than in the city limits of Lexington, because as everyone else in your podcast has talked about, that urban service boundary exists. It's not going anywhere. Population's growing and the housing supply can't. So what does that mean? Prices are going to go up, 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 up. And I want to be the owner of those assets that are going up, 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 up. So I love Lexington, both from, wanting to come back and live there, but also wanting to invest there.